Chapter 3. Miquel. Dura PDF Listening Station 272. The Turnabout. Miquel was a vast volcanic slab jutting from the black waters of the polar ocean, 16 kilometers long and 9 wide. From the air it looked bleak and lifeless. Sheer cliffs 100 meters high edged its shape, but its interior was a ragged desert of crags and rock litter. "Life signs?" I asked. Medea shrugged. We weren't picking anything up, but it was obvious from the jumping, hiccuping displays that the magnetics were playing hell with our instruments. "Shall I set down topside?" she asked. "Maybe," I said. "Bring us around for another pass to the south first." We banked. Cloud cover was low, and banks of chill fog swathed the island's gloomy sprawl. Fischig joined us in the cockpit. "You said there was an old facility here," I said. He nodded. "A listening station, used by the Planetary Defense Force in the early years after the liberation. Been out of use for a couple of decades now. It's high up in the interior. I've got a chart, Ref." "What's that?" Medea asked, pointing down at the southern cliffs. Down below, we could make out some derelict jetties, landing docks and prehab sheds clustered on a sea-level crag at the foot of the cliff. Some kind of vertical trackway, a row of rusting pylons, ran from the back of some of the larger sheds up the face of the cliff.
"That's the landing facility," said Fischig. "Used to serve the island when there were still PDF staffers stationed here."
"There's a sea craft down there," I said. "Fairly large." I looked across at Medea. "Put down there, the crag there beside the sheds. The cliffs will keep the cutter out of sight, too." It was bitingly cold, and the air was dank with fog and sea spray. Amos and Daholt stayed with Medea aboard the cutter, and the rest of us ventured out. On the ramp, I turned to Vervuk. "You stay aboard too, Bastian." He looked dismayed, that damned yearning look again. "I'd like to feel I have someone I can count on watching the cutter," I lied smoothly. His expression changed immediately. Pride, self-importance.
"But of course, Lord."
We crossed the crag in the lee of the high cliffs towards the prefabs. They were old pattern imperial modulars, shipped in and bolted together. Time and weather had much decayed them. Windows were boarded, and the fiber-ply walls were rotten and patched. Rain and spray had scrubbed away most of the surface paint and varnish, but in places you could just make out the faded crest of the Jura PDF. Haar and Fischig led the way. Haar had his long las raised to his shoulder, his foresight dropped into place, hunting for targets as he paced forward. Fischig carried a las rifle in one hand. A motion tracker unit was buckled over his left shoulder, whirring and ticking as it subjected Fischig's immediate vicinity to invisible waves of vigilance. Rassi and I were close behind them, with Elizabeth, Kara, and Burgundy at the rear. Fischig pointed to the vertical trackway we had seen from the air.
"Looks like a cable carriage or a funicular railway. Runs up to the clifftop."
"Functional?" Rassi inquired.
"I doubt it, sir," said Fischig. "It's old and hasn't been maintained. I don't like the look of those cables."
The main lifting lines were heavy-gauge hawsers, but they swung slackly in the wind between the pylons and showed signs of fraying.
"There are stairs, though," Fischig added. "Right up the cliff alongside the track."
We crossed to the jetties. They, too, were badly decayed. Rusting chains slapped and clanked with the sea swell. The craft moored there was a modern ocean-going ekranoplane, 20 meters long and sleekly grey. Stencils on the hull told us it was a licensed charter vessel from Finyard, presumably the vessel Thuring had hired to bring him here. There was no sign of crew, and the hatches were locked down. There wasn't even a hint of standby automation.
"Want me to force entry?" asked Kara.
"Maybe." I was interrupted by a shout from Haar. He was standing in the entrance of the nearest prefab, a docking shed that stood over the water on stilt legs. Haar gestured inside as I joined him. In the half-light, I could see four bodies slumped on the duckboards of the dry well. Fischig was kneeling beside them.
"Local mariners. Their papers are still in their pockets. Registered operators from Finyard."
"Dead how long?"
Fischig shrugged. "Maybe a day. Single shot to the back of the head in each case."
"The crew from the sea craft." He rose.
Makes sense to me.
Why didn't they dump the bodies at sea? Har wondered. Because an Ekranoplane is a specialist vehicle and they needed the crew alive to get them here, I suggested. But if they killed them once they were here, Har began. I was way ahead of him. Then they're not planning on leaving the island. Not the way they arrived, at any rate. I had Kara Swole break into the Ekranoplane. There was nothing useful inside, just a few items of equipment and personal clutter belonging to the murdered crew. The passengers had taken everything else with them. The only thing we learned was that Thuring might have as many as 20 men with him on Mikwal, giving the Ekranoplane's load capacity and the number of emergency life jackets. They've gone inland, I decided, and that's what we're going to.
Shall I get Dee to fire up the cutter?
Begundi asked. No, I said. We'll go in on foot. I want to get as close to Thuring as possible before he makes us. We can call in the cutter if we need it.
Medea won't like that, Gregor, said Beckwin.
I knew that damn well. I believe Medea deserved every chance to avenge her father. Vengeance might not be an appropriate motive for an Inquisitor, but as far as I was concerned, it was perfectly fine for a headstrong, passionate combat pilot. However, her passion could become a liability. I wanted Thuring taken cleanly, and I didn't relish the prospect of Medea going off in a blind fury. Beckwin was right, though. Medea really didn't like it.
I'm coming.
No.
I'm coming with you.
No. I caught her by the arms and stared into her face. You are not. Not yet.
Gregor,
she wailed.
Listen. Think about this logically. That bastard killed my father at...
Listen, I don't want the cutter giving us away too early. That means leaving it here. But I do want the cutter ready to respond at a moment's notice, and that means you have to stay here on standby. Medea, you're the only one who can fly it. She shook off my grip and turned away, gazing at the rolling surge of the ocean. Medea!
Okay.
But I want to be there when...
You will.
I promise.
You swear it?
I swear it. Slowly she turned to look at me. Her eyes were still bright with hurt.
Swear it on your secrets, she said.
What?
Do it the Glavian way.
Swear it on your secrets. I remembered this now. The Glavian custom. They considered an oath most binding if it was sworn against private, personal secrets. In the old days, I suppose, that meant one Glavian pilot swearing to exchange valuable technical or navigational secrets with another as an act of faith and honour. Midas had made me do it once, years before. He'd made me swear to a 3-month sabbatical at a time when I was working too hard. It hadn't been possible because of one case or another, and I ended up having to tell him that I adored Elizabeth and wished with every scrap of my being that we could be together. That was the deepest, darkest secret I had been carrying at the time. How things change. I swear it on my secrets, I told her.
On your gravest secret.
On my gravest secret. She spat on the ground and then quickly licked her palm and held out her hand. I mirrored her gestures and clasped her hand. We left her with Amos, Daholt, and Vervuk at the gun cutter and made our way up the cliff stairs. It was raining by the time we reached the top, and the last few flights were treacherously wet. Salty wind flapped in from the sea, gusting into our coats and clothes. I was worried about Paul Rassi. Though he didn't look it, he was over a century older than me, and the climb left him pale and breathless. He was relying on his cane more than before.
I'm all right, he said. Don't fuss.
Are you sure, Paul? He smiled.
I've been in the courts and privy chambers for too many of the last few years, Gregor. This is almost an adventure. I'd forgotten how much I liked this.
Rassi raised his cane and flourished it ahead of us like a sabre.
Shall we?
We advanced into the hinterland of Mikwal. Fischig had an Auspex locked off on the old PDF base, so we headed for that as a place to start. The sky was the luminous hazy white of a blown valve screen. Stripes of fog clung to the ground like walls of smoke. The rain was constant. The landscape was a mix of jagged upthrust outcrops and steep, shadowy valleys littered with scree. Boulders were scattered all around, some the size of skulls, some the size of battle tanks. The rock was dark, almost the colour of anthracite, and occasionally it was splintered out in cascades of volcanic glass. A forbidding, grey place. A monochrome world. After 2 hours we passed a rust-eaten tower of girders, capped by sagging, corroded alloy petals that had once been a communications dish. One of the peripheral receivers of the listening station.
"We're close," said Fischig, consulting his auspecs. "The PDF base is over the next headland."
Jura PDF Listening Station 272 had been established shortly after the planet's liberation by the newly formed Planetary Defense Force as part of a global overwatch program. Through it, and around 300 facilities like it, the Jura PDF had been able to maintain a round-the-clock watch of orbital traffic, local shipping lane activity, and even general warp space movements, providing the planet with an early warning network and gathering vital tactical intelligence for this part of the subsector in general. Over a period of 20 years following the annexation of the territory, the network had gradually been run down, eventually supplanted by a string of scanner beacons in high orbit and a slave subnet of sensor boys seeded throughout the Jura system. The PDF had finally vacated the obsolete stations some 3 decades before, undoubtedly grateful that they would never have to tolerate a tour of duty on this harsh rock again. The station lay on the shore of a long polar lake, framed by ragged infant mountains to the north. It was an exposed place, bitten by the sub-zero winds. The lake, smudged with mist, was a flat, gleaming mirror of oil-dark water, its glassy surface occasionally disturbed by a flurry of wind ripples. On the grey shore there were 18 longhouses arranged in a grid around a drum-like generator building, a hangar large enough to shelter several troop carriers or orbital interceptors, a cluster of store barns, a number of machine shops, a small ecclesiarchy chapel, a central command post with adjoining modules arranged in a radial hub, and the main dish array. All of it had succumbed to the feral Ministry of the Environment. The modules and prefabs were aged and dilapidated, windows covered with boards. The roadways between the prefabs were littered with rusting trash, old fuel drums, the carcasses of trucks, piles of flaking storm shutters. The vast main dish, angled towards the west, was a skeleton of its former self, just a hemisphere described by bare girders and dangling struts. In the black mirror of the lake, its reflection seemed like that of a giant, bleached ribcage. But it looked to me more like the ruins of an orrery, just the shattered remains of the central solar ball, permanently peering in the direction it had last been turned. Hugging cover, we made our way onto the cold shore and crossed the short distance to the nearest longhouse. We all had weapons drawn by now, except Burgundy. Fischig's auspex and motion tracker both indicated life signs close by, but how close they weren't telling. Thanks to the damn magnetic interference we were forewarned, but as good as blind. We were non-verbal by now. I gestured and sent Ha ahead down the left side of the street, Fischig down the right. I'd have liked to deploy Kara too, but she was keeping to my orders and sticking close to Rassi, her assault weapon tight in her gloved hands. Rassi, his sombre, fur-trimmed robes flapping in the wind, had produced a multi-barrel pepperpot handgun of exotic manufacture. Beckwin hung back from me, so that her psychic deadness wouldn't conflict with my mind. For the trek across Mikwal she had changed her formal gown for a quilted bodysuit and stout boots, with a hooded cloak of dark green embroidered velvet wrapped around her. I noticed she had also left her long walking cane aboard the cutter. She had drawn a slim, long-nosed micro-las that I had given her on her 150th birthday. It had pearl-inlaid grips and was a custom masterpiece, an antique made by Magos Noel of Gehenna. The pistol suited her. It was slender and elegant and devastatingly potent. Up ahead I saw Fischig signal to Ha. Ha knelt down and gave the big man some cover as he crossed to the back door of the next longhouse. I sent Burgundy forward in support. Burgundy still hadn't drawn his hand cannons from their shoulder rig, and ran with an easy, loping gait. Once Burgundy had reached him, Fischig slipped inside the longhouse. There was a pause, and then Burgundy went in too. We waited. Burgundy appeared in the doorway and beckoned to us. It was good to be out of the damp, though the dark, rot-stinking interior of the old prefab barrack wasn't much better. We got inside, and Ha and Kara stood guard at the doorway, with Burgundy covering the front. Fischig had found something. Fischig had found someone. It was an old man, filthy, wizened, lice-ridden and diseased. He cowered in the corner, whining each time the beam of Fischig's hand lamp probed at him. If I'd passed him on the streets of Ariel, I'd have taken him for a beggar and not given him a second look. Out here, though, it was different. "Give me the lamp," I said. The old man, who seemed more animal than human, shrank back as I turned the hard white light on him. He was caked in filth, starving and gripped by fear. But, despite the dirt, I could recognize his robes. "Father? Father Hierarch?" he moaned. "Father, we're friends." I unclasped my rosette and held it out to show him. "I am Inquisitor Gregor Eisenhorn, Ordo Xenos Helican. We are here in an official capacity. Don't be afraid." He looked at me, blinking, and slowly reached out a dirt-blackened hand towards the rosette. I let him take it. He looked at it for a long time, his hands trembling. Then he started to weep. I waved Fischig and the others back and knelt down beside him. "What's your name?"
Dronicus.
Dronicus?
Peter Herschel Dronicus, Hierarch of the Parish of Mickwall. Blessed be the God Emperor of mankind.
The God Emperor protects us all, I answered. Can you tell me how you come to be here, Father?
I've always been here,
he replied.
The soldiers may have gone, but while there is a chapel here, there is a parish. And so long as there is a parish, then there is a priest.
By the golden throne, this old fellow had lived here alone for 30 years, maintaining the chapel. They never deconsecrated the ground?
No, sir, and I am thankful. My duty to the parish has given me time to think.
Go med, Morlock, Ha muttered. Enough, I snapped over my shoulder. Let me see if I understand this right, I said to Dronicus. You served here as a priest, and when the PDF abandoned the site, you stayed on and looked after the chapel?
Yes, sir. That is the sum of it.
What did you live on?
Asked Fischig, that detective brain looking for holes in the story.
Fish,
he said. From his astonishingly foul breath, I believed that.
Fish. I went down to the landing point once a week and fished, smoking and storing the catch in the hangar. Besides, the soldiers left a lot of canned produce. Why, are you hungry?
No, said Fischig, unprepared for the generosity of the question.
Why are you hiding in here?
Beckwin asked softly. Dronicus looked at me as if needing my permission to answer. Go ahead, I nodded.
They drove me out, he said. Out of my hangar. They were mean. They tried to kill me. But I can run, you know.
I have no doubt. Why did they drive you out? Fischig asked.
They wanted the hangar. I think they wanted my fish.
I'm sure they did. Smoked fish. That's worth something out here. But they wanted something else, didn't they? He nodded, a bleak look on his face.
They wanted the space.
What for?
For their work.
What work?
They are mending their god.
I glanced sidelong at Fischig. Their god? What god is that?
Not mine, that's for sure,
Dronicus exclaimed. Then he suddenly looked reflective.
But it's a god, nevertheless.
Why do you say that? I asked.
It's big. Gods are big, aren't they?
Usually.
You said they,
said Rassi, crouching down next to me.
Who do you mean? How many of them are there?
Rassi's tone was admirably calm and reassuring, and I could feel the gentle bow-wake of the psychic influence he was cautiously bringing to bear. No wonder he had such a great reputation. I almost felt stupid for not asking such obvious questions.
The godsmiths,
the old priest replied.
I do not know their names, There are 9 of them. And also the other 9. And the 14 others. And the other 5.
37, breathed Fischig.
Dronicus screwed up his face.
Oh, there's a lot more than that. 9 and 9 and 14 and 5 and 10 and 3 and 16.
Grassi looked at me. Dementia, he whispered. He's able to account for them only in the groups he's seen them. He's not capable of identifying a whole. They are just numbers of people that he's seen at various times.
I'm not stupid,
cut in Dronicus simply.
I never said you were, father,
Rassi replied.
I'm not mad either.
Of course.
The old man smiled and nodded, and then, very directly, asked,
Do you have any fish?
Bus, Ha hissed suddenly. I rose quickly. What is it?
Movement, 30 meters.
His foresight was twitching as it downloaded the data. He knelt in the doorway and eased his rifle up to a firing position.
What do you see?
Trouble. 8 men, armed, moving like an infantry formation, coming this way.
We must have tripped something on the way in, said Burgundy.
I don't want to fight, not yet. I looked at the others. Let's exit that way and regroup.
We have to take him, said Rassi, indicating the old priest.
Agreed. Let's go. Burgundy opened the far door of the hut and led the way out. Beckwin followed him, then Fischig. Rassi reached out to help the old priest up.
Come on, father, he said.
Seeing the hand coming for him, Dronicus yelped.
Shit, we rambled, said Ha. They're coming.
Lasfire, bright and furious, suddenly hammered at the doorway and blew holes through the rotten fiber ply. Kara dived down for cover. Ha kept his place, and I heard his long las crack.
One down, he said.
Rassi and I hauled the old priest to his feet and bundled him towards the back exit. Behind us, the long las cracked again and was joined by the chatter of Kara Swole's assault weapon. Return fire hammered into the side of the longhouse, perforating the wall.
Get him out, I told Rassi and ran to the door.
Standing over Kara as she fired, I shot several bolt rounds through the gaping window. Las shots seared down the street and burst against the side of the hut. I got a glimpse of figures in bulky grey combat fatigues scurrying closer and pausing to unload their las rifles in our direction. A sudden thought, true and clear, lanced into my brain. I grabbed Kara and Ha. Move! I howled. We had made it to the rear door when the grenade took the front off the hut. The entire doorway area where Ha had been crouching erupted in a flash of flame and shredded fiber ply. The blast rush blew us out into the street. Fischig hauled me up.
Go! Go!
Kara was bleeding from a shrapnel wound on her temple, and Ha was dazed. But we ran, dragging them with us, up the muddy roadway towards the main dish. 3 men in insulated combat armor raced into the street ahead of us, raising las rifles. Burgundy's Hecuta pistols were in his hands faster than any of us could raise the weapons we already held. He blazed out twin streams of shots, the shell cases spraying out from the side slots of his weapons. All 3 men ahead of us lurched back and sprawled. Burgundy ran ahead, chopping down another 2 as they emerged, his handguns roaring. Then he dropped suddenly onto his back, rolled round and blasted another assailant off the roof where he had suddenly appeared. 5 more loomed behind us, breaking out of the rear door we had escaped through. Fischig and Kara turned, firing. They dropped 3 of them. Beckwin brought down the 4th with a single, well-placed headshot. A round from my bolt pistol knocked the 5th 5 meters back down the road.
Thorn, desiring Aegis, Patton Ulf,
my vox suddenly squawked. Medea was monitoring the activity over the vox link.
Negative. Thorn wishes Aegis repose under wing, I replied, using glossier, the informal private code I shared with my staff. Aegis stirred. The flower of blood. Aegis repose by the thrice ignited, as a statue to the end of earth.
Gregor, let me come.
No, Medea. No.
We were in a serious firefight now. Las shots and hard rounds whipped in all directions. Fischig and Ha laid down heavy cover fire. Kara and Beckwin selected targets more particularly and hit most of them. Burgundy blazed away with his matched handguns. I fired carefully, cautiously, keeping the old priest behind me. Rassi's fish and lock pepper pot banged and sparked and hailed lead balls at the enemy. Every few seconds he raised his cane and sent forth a drizzle of psychothermic flame from the silver tip. "Brace yourselves," I yelled. "You especially, Paul." He nodded. "Reveal yourselves," I urged, using the will at full force. Such a raw outburst would usually have floored all those around me, but Ha, Burgundy, and Kara had all been mentally conditioned during rigorous training to black out my psi streams. Beckwin was untouchable, and Fischig wore a torque that protected him. Rassi, forewarned, put up a mental wall. The old priest screamed, stood up, and wet himself. He wasn't the only one to stand up. Our attackers rose into view, each one clutching a smoking weapon, each one blinking in dumb confusion. Burgundy, Fischig, and I cut them all down in a few lethal seconds. Victory. For a moment. Suddenly, Dronicus was running away down the street, and Rassi was doubled up by convulsions. I felt it too, a sudden jolt in the background psionic resonance, like a painfully bright flash of light. I staggered back and slammed into the side of the nearest hut. Blood spurted out of my nose. Burgundy and Kara fell to their knees. Ha sat down hard, sobbing. Even Fischig, protected by his talk, felt it, and staggered. Elizabeth, the only one unmoved, glanced around us and yelled, "What? What is it?" I knew where it had come from. The hangar. I struggled upright in time to see the hangar roof quiver and buckle as something broke through it from inside. Something huge that smashed entire roof panels out of the way as it got to its feet. It must have been lying down in the hangar, I realized. Now it was rising and activated. What we had felt had simply been the backwash of its mind link going live. With dreadful certainty, I realized that Fade Thuring was going to be damn near impossible to stop. I had made an unbelievable, unforgivable mistake. I had underestimated him and his resources. He was nothing like the minor warp dabbler I had once let slip away. He had a titan, Emperor damn him. He had a battle titan.